This is the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Fur Neiman. If you're looking to generate wealth and passive income in the lucrative world of mobile home parks, you're in the right place. You'll discover solutions to the common legal and operational pitfalls and how to optimize parks to maximize income. Your host is in the trenches. He's a real estate attorney, financial analyst, and mobile home park investor and operator. Now, let's turn it over to Fur Neiman.
Welcome back, Mobile Home Park Nation. Fur Neiman here again today with another episode of the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast. Got a pair of guests for you today. So two for one is going to be extra special for lease communities. I've got Vincent Tao and Elizabeth Woods. Vincent, Elizabeth, thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Fur.
Thanks so much. Well,
yes.
Yeah. Well, look forward to talking to you guys. I know it's been several months since we've seen each other in person, so it's nice to be able to jump back together on the screen here. I know you guys a little bit. What for our group that doesn't, why don't you guys tell us a little more of your background and how you got into MH, and then we can go from there.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for again. Excited to be on the podcast. I have been listening to first podcast for some time, and I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, but I would say that the depth and nuances covered in this podcast are pretty rare, even amongst the other fellow podcasts. So my name is Vincent Tao. I am an immigrant, came to U.S. about 18 years ago. My background is in mostly engineering and finance. Before I delve into real estate, I worked on the Wall Street for about over a decade. But I always knew that I have some interest in real estate. And before getting to mobile home parks, I invested in some other type of real estate, like condos, single family houses, and apartments. Apartments especially are interesting because it has share a lot of the common attributes as mobile home parks, but also differ in many other ways. We can delve into that a little later. But I would say it is the apartment investment that led me to mobile home parks, because I remember I was having a conversation with some fellow apartment investor, and that's the first time I heard about mobile home parks back in January 2019. This is the first time I heard about it, and by February 2019, I actually attended the mobile home park boot camp by Frank Rolfe. That was a very enlightening experience, and that prompted me to get into this space. 1 month later, I actually quit my job, my full-time job in Wall Street, and I started full-time in real estate. By July 2019, I purchased my first mobile home park, which is a small park, 29 lot in Greenview, South Carolina. That deal was great success, but you know, COVID hits in 2020 and everything went to a grinding halt. It took me another 12 months to purchase the second park. Then it started rolling. So right now our company have about 11 parks under our belt across three states. So now let me turn the mic to Elizabeth, my partner.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us, Ferd, and for all the contributions you made to this space. So I grew up in Kentucky. So, of course, I'd seen my share of mobile home parks. You know, didn't really think that much about them. And then I am actually a pharmacist by training. So, unfortunately, not as translatable as a skill as yourself and Vincent, you know, law and finance. But I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit. So I find myself running independent pharmacies. So I did get, you know, some business background there. And one of which of these pharmacies was actually on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And that tidbit will be important later. So keep that in mind. But, you know, I wasn't satisfied running somebody else's business. I felt like a hamster on a wheel, like most of us do, working for the man. And I just really wanted to find a way to make passive income. To me, real estate always made the most sense. It's just, you know, very concrete. My family was in real estate on my dad's side, so I had a little background there. But I wanted to do something on my own. So I really started researching in the space, listening to podcasts, and I eventually narrowed it down to mobile home parks. And since that day in 2019, when I decided I was going to invest in parks, I have purchased 8 parks and a commercial building. And one of these transactions, it was 2 parks and a commercial building. That was my first deal. That's actually gone through the full cycle, you know, the purchase, the diligence, the running, the improving, and then the selling of that park, which was also a huge success. We sold it for over twice what we purchased it for about less than 2 years later. So, you know, this space is, it's amazing. You know, you got to find the right deal and the right people to work with and that kind of thing. But I'm very happy. I also quit my job in pharmacy and became a full-time real estate investor. And it's important that I was working in Manhattan because during my time in Manhattan, the story of Vincent and I meeting is so interesting. And it's just funny how life comes full circle. Vincent hosted a meetup group in Manhattan about mobile home parks where he discussed his first park purchase in Greenville. And I was just so impressed with him because I hadn't bought any parks yet. And so I just really enjoyed hearing his story and learning from him. So I stayed after and we connected and, you know, exchanged numbers, kept in contact. And then it just so happened that just after that, Vincent moved to Atlanta. Then I went back to Kentucky for a little while and then I eventually ended up moving to Augusta, Georgia because of my husband's job. So when I moved, I knew Vincent was in Atlanta and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to reach out to Vincent and see what he's up to. And we sat down, had coffee, had a conversation, and he and I have been investing in parks ever since. And you can really scale in this industry, which is something I love. We have some really interesting stories together of purchases we've made. Our first purchase was an 80-lot park, and then we called the owner. We saw another park touch that property and it was 40 lots. So, you know, we bought our 80 lot park. We call the owner with the 40 lot park touching it, turn that into a 120 lot park and through cold calling. Then we see that there's another property half a mile up the road and it's 75 lots and 17 single family homes. We cold called and, you know, followed up with the guy, showed up at his door and ended up purchasing that as well. So it's really neat if you're willing to, and Vincent really pushed me on this, if you're really willing to do the cold calling and the, if they don't answer, show up at their door and build that relationship with people. That's how Vincent and I have gotten most of our deals. So, really enjoy working together. It's just by chance. It's crazy how life works out, but it's been really good.
No, that's great. Yeah. I mean, that's good that you guys could find a partnership from, you know, 2 different parts of the world, so to speak, and come together and partner, you know, add all your supplement each other, compliment each other, all that. So that's great. And yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head on finding deals, you know, finding off market deals, cold calling, building rapport. It's harder to scale like that, but it's how you can, you know, if you got a deal you like, that's often the way to do it. Right. I mean, it's hard for, you know, people that are, you know, small, the medium size to compete against the REITs and the big private equity groups on market deals. So it's like, that's where you can make your money is on the buy, and you're going to make your money on the buy on the deal that is hard to find. It's hard to get to the owner. So
definitely
some wisdom in that strategy. So that's good. That's how you told us how you found a couple of your deals. So tell us about operations. And Vincent, you mentioned you've got an apartment background. So I'm interested in your view on MH versus apartments. And then just in general, Elizabeth, I'm curious how you use your, you know, pharmaceutical skills and entrepreneurial skills, you know, to supplement the business. And just kind of interested in what you guys have learned and how we can learn from you to improve our own operations.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, definitely. So you know, I've been investing in apartment for probably a few years before the mobile home park. So there's a lot of similarities between the two, given both in the, you know, multifamily space. A lot of the apartments we were looking at are in also class class B or class C. And sometimes they are in the similar area as well. But you know, there's also a lot of differences, and you know, there's pros and cons between both asset classes. So I would say the one major difference is that the, you know, I usually draw the comparison between apartments and mobile home park. I would call apartments as or mobile home park as, you know, standalone apartments. Essentially, especially if you operate a park-owned home model, where basically all of your tenants, you collect rent, you're responsible for all the maintenance and the repair, you do all the improvements. If you run that model, mobile home park actually will make, I would say, on average, a bigger percentage of a profit, just because the repair maintenance is easier. When you don't share walls and roofs, so the you know if there's a water leak for one unit, you don't have to worry about the water leak going to the downstairs in apartments. And also the in terms of the code, the building code, etc. It's also a lot easier. With regard to the lender as well as the insurance company. Insurance company and lender usually have pretty strict requirements for the apartments. But of course, if you're using Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, then there's no difference. The other thing I would say is in the apartment space, it's very difficult to do any off market deal. You know, occasionally you might be able to find a pocket listing, but it's overall, it's, you know, not many people cold call apartment owners because most of these are institutional owners anyway. But mobile home park is completely different, and there's still a lot of opportunity to call the mom and pops. And the other main thing that's different, but I also find it pretty intriguing, is that the unit number or the size of apartments usually is a lot bigger than mobile home parks, and which also kind of justify their purchase prices. Oftentimes, maybe like 5 times or 10 times of apartments in the same area, 10 times of a mobile home park in the same area. It's not unusual to find 200 unit apartment building or even like 400 unit apartment building, but it's a much rare to find mobile home park in that size. A 60 space mobile home park is a decent size, but 60 unit apartment is relatively small. In the spectrum of all the available listings. So that's another reason why the apartment is more geared toward institutional owners. There's also on the flip side, I would say, apartment investing has been around for a lot longer years, and there's a lot of training programs or a lot of more mentors in the space that can guide you through the apartment investing. But in mobile home park space, there are learning programs, but besides the boot camp has been there for quite some time. The other programs are pretty new, and it's not as well structured as apartment investing, I would say. So all in all, I just, if I have to choose one, that's how I made a choice, that I find there's a lot more opportunity in the mobile home park business versus the apartments, because apartments has been favored by a lot of people, and the space has been very crowded. Even though mobile home park is getting more competitive, but it's nowhere near the competitiveness in the apartments.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, thanks for your input there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think too, something I would add, because I also looked at, you know, a bunch of different areas in real estate and just, you know, the cost of entry, you know, I mean, it just seems incredible to try to buy, you know, a multi-million dollar apartment complex. So that just didn't seem reasonable to me. Another reason I chose Parks too, it's easier to scale versus buying single family homes, but you know, it's still attainable for all of us. So, you know, I don't want any new people in the space to get discouraged because, you know, we've only been doing it for a few years and it's really incredible what you can accomplish in the park space.
I forgot to add one point that I feel there's a lot more creative strategies in the mobile home park space versus apartments, because in apartment, you own the home. There's not much you can do in terms of, you know, shifting the ownership of individual units to the tenant. But in mobile home space, you have many different ways, rent to own or tenant own home. You can easily infilling units compared to, you know, building a new apartment building that's a lot more work. So there's just a lot more different ways to add value in the park space, I would say.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely MH is more creative nowadays, in particularly because you have some unsophisticated sellers. So there's just more opportunity for some ground leases or a master lease concept, seller finance. Sometimes there's, you know, you buy the homes and not the land, you buy the land, not the homes. There's other, you know, sub-tenant Lonnie dealers within the parks. And, you know, to Elizabeth's point, you can buy a mobile home park at a, you know, the smaller park in particular at a pretty attainable price. And then to Vince's point, you know, part of the reason, you know, I was doing single family and I decided, oh, let's get into apartments. There's economies of scale. And then I got there, I was like, everybody already figured this out. This is really expensive. I can't compete, you know, perhaps from sophistication, but certainly from a capitalization with some of these other players. For an MH space, it's like, all right, I can kind of hang in this space. And it's like, you know, it's not a simple business by any means. I think it's probably more active than the apartment space. It's harder to get third party professional management. So I feel like the vast majority of park owners are also park operators, whereas in the apartment space, it's a lesser ratio. You know, that has its own pros and cons, but yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's still opportunity in both. We do some apartment work on the legal side here. I've got investments in some apartments as well, but I think that, you know, from a profitability standpoint, there's more unturned stones to be found in the manufactured housing classification than in the multifamily apartment classification.
Exactly. Absolutely. I agree. The window of opportunity hasn't closed for parks yet. You know, we were able to just find, and we just looked in the small area around where we lived, because to your point, you do need to self-manage a lot and you do need to go check on your property because you don't have that professional, you know, management group there. So for us, we looked in the smaller area around where we live and we'll expand out, but that's just been much more manageable for us to oversee our properties and our investments. So we are, you know, very involved in that aspect of everything. And that's been really helpful for us.
Yeah. I mean, the management, to first point that the management is the key in the mobile home park business, because especially for tenant-owned home park, where the income is, there's a lot less expense, but the income is also quite limited. So in order to hire a full-time manager, a lot of times you can't afford to do that. And then you would have to use a lot of creative ways to manage virtually, or to hire a virtual assistant to turn a lot of the work online. So there's not a need to have an on-site person full-time. That's the only way to manage some of these parks. So yeah, you know, that's what we are kind of exploring in the past couple of months, because the one issue we found after owning these parks is that, you know, we can't, we're not able to manage to the same standard as when we only have one or two parks, which we can dedicate a lot more time to individual tenant. But now when you have over 10 parks, then, you know, you have to have a lot of other people to help you to manage. And, you know, that's when we started to really think about how we can make the system more scalable and to leverage more of other people's time to help us manage. And, you know, it's still been work in progress, but I think with the knowledge, you know, the leverage of the technology, the virtual assistant, a good property management software, that makes a lot easier to manage parks, and we're more confident to acquire more when we have this system in place.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, mobile home parks give a unique opportunity for management because of the size, and because you mentioned top line revenue on a tenant home park, it's not that much, right? So, I mean, I've got a 20 space park in Iowa, and it's like, I can't afford a full-time manager, or even a low paid, you know, $25,000 a year full-time manager. So that park cannot support it. So we go with the park greeter model on that, which is somebody that lives in the park and gets free or reduced lot rent. And this guy doesn't even get fully free. He gets reduced lot rent. He has minimal duties. We have minimal homes come vacant. If they do, we give them commissions for that. We pay him hourly to mow the grass. And, you know, he walks around and, you know, gives out trash violations and is a nosy neighbor. And we hear from him once a month. And it's a pretty easy park with high collection, like 100% collections, and no real problems. Now, if we do get more problems, or we have challenges with collections, or have numerous homes go vacant. Now, we don't have any rental homes there, so that's okay. We sold them all, so that makes it easier as well. But right. You know, we don't really need a lot of staff. You know, we probably this guy probably works an hour or two a week, and then plus mowing 4 hours a time for a portion of the year. So that's a much different staffing structure than a park where we're going to bring in 25 homes this year and, yeah, you know, put in the concrete, put in the driveways and build the decks and skirt the homes and go through the permit process and sell them with a lender and go through all that paperwork. And, you know, there you need maintenance and management.
Right.
And more, you know, headquarters oversight.
Exactly. And really reliable people on the ground who can do that stuff for you. In my Illinois parks, we did quite a bit of infilling. Really interesting tidbit, and it's a little different everywhere you go, but we got really lucky. We purchased two parks, and the smaller one is 26 lots, and it was mostly vacant. We had to sell or finance it. And we ended up realizing that a few of the homes sitting there in our park, you know, the taxes hadn't been paid on them, so they were tax sale homes. So that's something that I've been really successful with, is buying homes in tax sales. It varies, you know, by county and state, but that's been a really neat way for me to do big infilling at low prices, you know, less than $1,000 for a home already sitting there. And you don't have to find all the crews to, you know, install it or get it improved, you know, approved. Newer homes are a much bigger animal. So that's something that I found helpful, and I encourage people to look into that locally, because I know the used home market, you know, with COVID and all the newer homes, you know, took you forever to get one and prices were so high. I feel like the used home market is essentially nothing if you're trying to find them yourself. So, and then I think, Ferd, you kind of asked me how pharmacy relates to mobile home park investing, and I truly hadn't thought about that before. But now that you say it, and something else that's really helped us, especially through COVID time, is, you know, as a pharmacist, I was responsible for helping people afford or get their medications no matter what. So I did a lot of patient assistance programs and that kind of thing. And something we've been really successful with in South Carolina and some other states is the assistance program, you know, for rent. So something we did, it was a very tedious tedious process. So we ended up incentivizing our on-site manager to help with that paperwork by giving her a bonus every time, you know, we got the check from the program there as SC Stay Plus. So I think that's something that really made sense to me, you know, to help people pay their rent, get ahead. You know, the more money they have in the pocket, the more money they have to pay you in rent even down the road. So that's been something that has helped us a lot. We still made people pay a little bit because we realized if the checks take a while to get there, but, you know, it would be thousands of dollars at a time. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. The rental assistance program has been really helpful to us. In the, you know, in the space, in the states we're in, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, you know, a lot, well, I mean, this year all the funds are running out, but last year it helped quite a bit of, I would say at least 30 to 50 tenants. We got them funding, wow, rental assistance. And yeah, so it's been really helpful. I guess it kind of depending on the state, some states are a lot easier to get a funding versus the others, but our model is we don't file eviction right away. We usually always try to work with the tenant whenever possible. You know, after the fifth month, we will usually give them, you know, a notice and try to see if they can give us a day when they can pay. And then if they say they can pay, then we try to see if we can, you know, point them to rental assistance or set up a payment plan that suits their, you know, their ability to, you know, for the income. Or only when they don't respond, then, you know, then we will send them the non-renewal letter. But then, you know, usually 2 days after non-renewal letter, we want to also give them a cash for key letter, to see if they want to move out. And usually at that point, they're going to talk to us. And sometimes we can make agreements, sometimes cannot. If not, then we just go ahead with the eviction. But that way, we feel like we know a lot of people were struggling during COVID, and also especially right now, the recession, and there's, you know, more and more people are lost jobs. And so, you know, we try to be aware of the current, you know, economic situation and try to help people. But at the same time, we want to be fair to everyone. So we usually don't waive late fees unless we set up a payment plan. Then at that point, if they follow through the payment plan, we will waive some late fees. But if they miss the payment plan, we're going to double their late fees. So we want to make it very, make them aware that they have to follow through their promises in order to stay in the community. And so far it's been working well. Our delinquency has come down quite a bit after we adopt that approach.
No, that's good that it's working. I mean, for us, we have a lot of people that use the government programs as well during COVID time. Some of the states, some are running out of money. I know like Illinois, yeah, we own, I don't know, 6 or 7 parks in Illinois, and Illinois is out of money now. And
yeah,
I think what the system has done is it's taught these people bad habits that they don't have to pay their bills. We have some people that have not paid rent in 15 months. They fall behind 3 months. You know, we file for eviction right away. The court in Illinois is now giving them a court appointed attorney, and then they're forced to go to mediation. And then at mediation, they say, we'd like to get on a payment plan with government aid. Okay, government aid shows up, government aid pays it. 3 months later, runs out, repeat. 3 months later, runs out, repeat. And now the government's out of those funds. So yeah, this guy is probably not going to pay. So he's going to live there for 18 months, and then finally the government quit paying. So I do think we're going to come in as an industry, really more as a society, we're going to have a major problem coming down the pike where people were taught bad habits. And we're seeing home sales right now. People that are making $70,000 a year can't get approved for a $50,000 mobile home because during COVID they didn't pay their rent, or during COVID They got a nice fat STEMI check, and they used his down payment to buy a $90,000 souped up truck, and their truck payment's $1,100 a month. And now they can't now they can't get a house, despite having a nice middle class job, you know, buying an inexpensive home. So yeah, I think to be determined how this is going to shake out. But I think a lot of these people are going to be at the soup kitchen a year from now with no home, no credit, no money, because they got these bad habits from all these STEMIs and everything else.
Yeah, that's
frustrating. Yeah, I mean, definitely there's a lot of people not going to make it. You know, I would say the same thing. But, you know, we at least give them, I would say, I mean, after a couple of months, if they the money runs out and they start to be delinquent, then, you know, they will still be evicted. But we were trying to, you know, every time we tell them the when we got the funding, we always send them a letter saying, hey, now you got a couple of months free free rent, but here's what you need to do. You need to start saving some money. You need to try to, you know, be more responsible for your finance. And sometimes we even send them some you know, free resources how to, you know, sort out your finances and things like that. Some people will take the advice, some people don't. And, you know, then after a couple of months, I mean, if they don't take any advice and they don't sort out their finance, then it's really on them. And there's, you know, anyone who can't help themselves, no one can help them. So, well, you know, we have to let them go at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, one of our on-site managers is a retired social worker. So she's been able to put together really good guides of, you know, where people can get help. Because even if they get help with, you know, groceries or utilities, then they have more money to pay their rent. So that's also been helpful for us through churches or things like that, the people that really need that help.
That's it. That's not a bad approach either. All right, guys, this is good. What any before we could jump here, any other tips or tricks or stories you want to share?
Yeah, sure. So one thing I want to touch upon is, you know, in terms of the, you know, I know a lot of people interested in acquisition. And so, you know, Elizabeth already mentioned quite a bit in terms of the you know, talking to seller for the, you know, cold calls through the, you know, so one thing I want to say is that if your target is a park in the same area you're living, staying, I would say, try to show your face makes a huge difference. There, you know, two cases, one that, you know, deal that was Elizabeth, and also another deal, one of my first few deals, that we were almost like we were in discussion with the seller for the park, but he has like three buyers offering the same term for the park. And I got the park. The only difference is that I show up at his door and he was not home. And then I drop a note. And then after that, he actually called me back. He said, I don't know. I see anyone, you know, actually show up in my house and my camera can't capture your image. Like, aren't you afraid being shot? I said, I didn't even thought about that.
But, I am now.
Yes. But that makes a difference. And then, you know, we go through that process. That deal probably took me 6 months to close. But, and then we become good friends. Like, whenever I have any issues or need any help reference on contractor in the area, he is very, you know, he always, before we close, he probably pick up my phone, you know, 3 out of 10 times. Now he pick up the phone probably 9 out of 10 times. So I would say
he's got all that free time. He's not managing that park. He's looking for you took his work, so now he's bored.
Yeah. Well, he always complained I sold it too cheap to you. But to the point that, you know, when you cold call, you definitely the relationship really matters in this business. It's really about the person. A lot of times when you have the good relationship, the price or the term doesn't matter as much. And then the other thing I want to touch upon is in terms of the financing, because especially right now, the financing are challenging for, you know, to get a bank financing. The rates are pretty high, so a lot of people trying to do the seller financing. And the you know, some of the, I guess some of the deals we did in the past, we tried to do, you know, some combination, and where you got a, you know, you will get the bank financing cover maybe like 75%, but then you will try to work out another agreement to get a secondary loan with the seller, and sometimes it could be collateralized on the property, but sometimes you cannot. So in those cases, we actually try to collateralize on some other properties, so in order to get the secondary lien. And you know, sometimes we also negotiate with the lender in terms of the CapEx budget, and that proves you know, very useful when you have a turnaround park to do the work, to paving roads, to you know, to trim trees, to do, you know, waterline works and things like that. So I would say trying to be more creative in terms of financing, that would make a huge difference for the financial return. The lending is, you know, pretty much the bulk of the money that's invested into the property.
Yeah, it's definitely more challenging today's environment with the interest rates the way they are, and you know, it's hard to get a quality loan at this moment.
So what's your strategy for financing in the current situation?
Well, I mean, deal flow is slowing as a result of interest rates. I mean, you could try seller finance. That's hard to do. I don't really want to get agency loans right now and lock in these rates because there's a big prepayment or yield maintenance penalty. So I think the strategy is, you know, put up a little more equity, get a recourse local bank loan, and hope rates go down in 2-3 years and then refinance out of it. And in the meantime, you got a you know, a local bank loan with a, you know, interest rate that, good grief, it might be 7% today. Certainly not going to be sub-6, unless it's a big project. But I mean, just for a kind of a small, medium-sized deal, you know, 500,000 to 1.5 million, you're probably looking at the high 6s right now.
Yeah.
And maybe 7. So it's hard to buy a deal that's, you know, a 6 cap even, you know, it's not going to pencil very easily. You got to start putting 35% down instead of 20 or 25, or you got to buy a deal that's a 9 cap, which is really hard to find.
Right. Right. Well, I hope the cap rate probably going to rise with the interest rate in the short term. And, you know, hopefully 2024, the rate's going to, I mean, that was the forecast to, the rate's going to drop in 2024. But we're kind of in the same boat. We are not in the active acquisition mode right now. But we feel like there will be, there might be some motivated seller later this year when, if their loan is about to, you know, expire, or, you know, they have personal situation that they have to sell. So we are, you know, hoping there's going to be more deal in the later half of this year.
Yeah, agreed. And then the people we cold call with, you know, we continually follow up with people. So, you know, we have a, you know, a streamline going of deals, and you never know when exactly they're going to work out or pan out or whatever. But we've actually been pretty successful with seller financing through building those relationships. You know, you trust the person, and you can get a lot more accomplished when, you know, when they trust you back. So that's probably what we'll kind of be aiming for. We went through a loan broker for one of our deals, and that was helpful as well. So I would tell people to check into that if they're having issues finding funding.
That's a good point. Yeah, I've used loan brokers in the past, and it depends on the deal size and location as to which broker to use and what lenders they're ultimately going to find and all that. But they can certainly help. I often will try to get a local lender that's local to that property, or once you get a good relationship with a local lender, they'll follow you around, even outside of the state. Sometimes there's restrictions. I had one time where they would not follow me outside of the state because their bank charter didn't really allow it, and they would have to do a bunch of hoops that they were unwilling to. So sometimes you got to ask the bank. I'll do it early on, like, are you lending in this state, or will you lend in this state for this type of asset, and get a quick no before I even put together a loan package or anything like that, because you don't want to waste time. Mm-hmm. That happened to me one time where I went through the whole process and committee approval, and then got committee approval. Then I got board approval. Mm-hmm. And then the CEO vetoed it. He's like, we're not doing any loans in that state. Our charter is not there. We sometimes make exceptions, but we're not making exceptions this year. You know, so like, what?
Yeah.
So, you know, part of the process, right, is figuring out who your capital partners are, whether it's your own capital, or you've got investors, or you've got lenders. Is it the seller or your capital partner in some respect? So, yeah, there's lots of options. You know, be creative out there.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate your time. Look forward to catching up with you guys more. Till next time, thanks and God bless.
Thank you, Fern.
Thank you, Fern. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Fern Neiman. Ready to learn more? Go to www.themobilehomelawyer.com for free resources and materials to help you succeed. If you love the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts, give us your review, and subscribe today. Thank you for listening. Neither the Supreme Court of Missouri nor the Missouri Bar reviews nor approves certifying organizations or specialist designations. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.